So I want to keep going with our theme of death as the ultimate teacher. And we can think of the story of Prince Siddhartha and being protected from the troubles of life as maybe only possibly a prince could. But his life of you know, deep sensory pleasure was challenged very much by seeing the realities of life. And of course the realities of life are that we do have sense pleasure and we can really enjoy it. So not to deny that. But we could, if we take the story of the heavenly messengers as allegory, it seems to be saying that a life of comfort and ease and sensory pleasure doesn't quite do it for us. Because the problem with sensory pleasures is they are slippery. You might have noticed that with lunch, as pleasant as your meal was, that pleasure is gone. And you I've noticed this on retreat. You know, when my mind gets really aware that the food that comes into my mouth is really pleasant at first, but as I keep chewing, it just sort of becomes mush in the mouth. It still might have a good flavor, but it's kind of just like oatmeal. And then I have to swallow that. So we start to kind of lose some enchantment with sensory pleasure. We get that we can enjoy it very much while it lasts, but it doesn't last. And so the topic of mortality is really just a macro teaching of our micro experience. And the micro experience is pleasure is slippery. Instead of it being something that just lands and we're satisfied and we're complete, it's more like it flows through us and we experience pleasure and we can enjoy it and it's nice and then it's gone. And in some ways it doesn't leave us much better off. It's just that it was enjoyable for a little while. So when we hold the heavenly messengers as more metaphorical, it's really saying that our sensory experience can't give us the deep happiness and satisfaction that we want. We all want to be happy, but we want more than that. We want to be happy all the time, right? Wouldn't that be awesome? And so the Buddhist teaching is really an effort to get super real about life so that we can really dig deep and devote ourselves to a path that does lead to a much deeper, more long-lasting happiness. And so one of the realities the path asks us to confront, because we better confront it since it's true, is our mortality. And we can't get out of it. We got this gift of life. But the gift is that the gift has an expiration date. The trouble is the date isn't stamped on the package. So we don't know when the expiration date is. So it's very challenging. And yet, this is the situation. So our only choice is to make the best of it. We don't have to choose to make the best of it. We can make the worst of it. We're free to. But since we have choice, why not make the best of it? And so necessarily, we want to consider what's actually good about death, about mortality. Can anyone think of something possibly good about it? Please. So I'll just summarize just the end. Death serves as a contrast to life, and so it really makes us appreciate life. And we do. We have a nervous system that's built on contrast. We know things through contrast. So that's a big contrast, the light and the dark. What else? Please. If everybody lived forever, it'd be kind of crowded. So not so good for the earth. Please. So if reincarnation is true, we get a fresh start. We get to try out a different form. Please. So death can relieve suffering when the body wears out. So I'm going to share a few, add to your reflections and share a few more. So Rodney Smith is a Buddhist teacher in our Vipassana tradition who has spent much of his professional life as a hospice caregiver. And he has a book called Lessons from the Dying, just about many, many stories about what he's learned from attending people as they die. So he writes this. A 47-year-old hospice patient looked out of her window at the ocean, glistening in the morning sun. She's at home, so she's getting home care. After quietly observing the view for a long time, she finally said, "Having grown up in this house, I have seen the sun shine on the water many times, but I have never appreciated it as I do now. Seeing it like this brings me a great deal of joy." So similar to what some of you said, that dying actually really sort of drops us into feeling and experiencing the preciousness of life. And if you've ever been with somebody dying in a conscious way, someone who's not in reaction to dying, there can actually be a huge gift of presence in the person who is let go and is kind of willingly surrendering this body. It can be a huge gift of presence. And so whatever you think about dying, it might not be how you think it's going to be. We don't quite know how we're going to be. We have no idea. But we need to be around others, you know, to even have an inkling of the mystery of this process. So if we take the lesson of dying as one of appreciating the preciousness of life, one of the lessons, I want to tell a story now that is going to relate to this. So this is from Mark Epstein, who's a psychoanalyst, psychiatrist, and he's a meditator and has written a lot on the interface of meditation and psychology. So he wrote, "Traveling in Asia in my early 20s with my American Buddhist teachers, Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, and Richard Alpert, who became Ram Dass. I woke up after an all-night train ride from Bangkok to find myself in the forest monastery of a Thai meditation master named Ajahn Chah. Psychologically minded Westerners pillaging the wisdom of the East, trolling for some seed or shoot that might take root in American soil. When we met Ajahn Chah, we hurriedly constructed a question so as to generate a reply. I can no longer remember our question, but Ajahn Chah's response still lingers. Before saying a word, he motioned to a glass at his side. "Do you see this glass?" he asked us. "I love this glass. It holds the water admirably. When the sun shines on it, it reflects the light beautifully. When I tap it, it has a lovely ring. Yet for me, this glass is already broken. When the wind knocks it over or my elbow knocks it off the shelf and it falls to the ground and shatters, I say, 'Of course.' But when I understand that the glass is already broken, every minute with it is precious." So this is a beautiful teaching. And it's almost the opposite of what we would think. We would think, well, this glass is already broken. I remember a friend who wasn't practicing much but had heard this and just could not stand this little teaching, because to them it just felt like, well, okay, great, life sucks. It's all going to fall apart. It's, you know, what's the point? You know, they interpret it that way. And so I learned to never say, well, you know, it's already broken around him. He's saying if we pre-understand how things are, that everything is impermanent, rather than it being morose, you just appreciate the beauty of everything, you know? I liked when I was part of the Vajradhatu Sangha in the 80s, the students of Trungpa Rinpoche, they used to say, "We're not here for a long time, we're here for a good time." And so impermanence, really, rather than being a bummer, actually makes us show up for just the miraculousness of being alive. So let's consider death in the context now of our spiritual path. And there's a way in which it's a real positive if we are interested in having a spiritual life. I don't quite know how people do it without a spiritual life. I don't quite know how people watch their bodies and minds fall apart and not have a worldview somehow bigger than one's own small self. I personally don't know how to do that. I only know how to confront all this because practice can give us a much larger perspective where we're not identified with this body, which is going one direction, and this mind, which is also going the same direction. A spiritual life helps us be bigger than our own individual self. And so, as I said in the morning, the genius of the Buddhist path is it's taking something as challenging as dying and making it not just something we tolerate or accept, but something that actually is a benefit to our spiritual life, which means a benefit to our heart. So Bhikkhu Bodhi is a long, long time monk. In the Theravada tradition. He's a Western monk. He's been in robes. I don't know how long. He's a brilliant scholar, and he's translated most of the Pali canon into the books that we all read, the actual sayings of the Buddha, what the Buddha said. Bhikkhu Bodhi's the main translator. So he writes about these heavenly messengers. They're heavenly only if linked to a spiritual path. They're messengers from heaven if we link them up. To become divine messengers, the facts of aging, illness, and death must jolt us into an awareness of the fragile, precarious nature of our normal day-to-day lives. When we meet the divine messengers at this level, they become catalysts that can induce in us a profound internal transformation. We realize that because we are frail and inescapably mortal, we must make drastic changes in our priorities and values. Instead of letting our lives be consumed by transient trivia, by things that are here today and gone tomorrow, we must give weight to what really counts, to aims and actions that will exert a lasting influence upon our long-range destinies. The preliminary message of the messengers is the announcement that our house is ablaze. The final message is other, and a buoyant cry that there is a place of safety, an open field beyond the flames, and a clear exit sign pointing the way of escape. If in this process of awakening we must meet old age, sickness, and death face to face, that is because the place of safety can be reached only by honest confrontation with the stark truths about existence. When we look at the divine messenger squarely, we will find that their faces undergo a metamorphosis. Before our eyes, by subtle degrees, they change into another face, the face of the Buddha, with a serene smile of triumph over the army of Mara, over the demons of desire and death. The divine messengers point to what lies beyond the transient, to a dimension of reality where there is no more aging, no more sickness, and no more death. This is the goal and final destination of the Buddhist path, Nibbana, the unaging, the unailing, the deathless. It is to direct us there that the divine messengers have appeared in our midst, and the good news of deliverance is their message. So he's basically saying there is an out. We could say that the small self is mortal. This body, this mind, this personality does die. But according to the Buddhist belief, there's something that transcends all of that, which is this ability each of us has to fully awaken in this very mind and body. And so death then is this spur. It's sort of the spur, the burr under the saddle, that motivates us, that activates, jumpstarts our spiritual path. And remember what Carlos Castaneda said, you know, talk to your death. It's stalking you, and it's just an arm's length away to the left behind you. It can give you the perspective of really? Am I going to really want to look back on this from my deathbed and say, this is where I put all my energy? And then the Buddhist answer of where to put your energy is awakening. And I want to talk about awakening from two perspectives. First is just, you know, the more kind of formal sense of it. What do we really mean in Buddhism when we say enlightenment? But then I want to help it be more personal for you, because you might not be sitting here with an aspiration that, oh, I'm here, you know, on this planet to achieve full enlightenment. That might not be what you're after. But my guess would be you're definitely after everything that takes you there. We're just going to make it more personal. So the out is awakening, is waking up. And essentially, we could say there's many different ways of talking about awakening. One is to drop the fiction of separateness. All of our pain and our suffering comes from feeling separate. We all understand that there's this deep, deep yearning of our heart to belong, to feel that we belong. And what gets in the way of belonging is this little mini-me that we believe we have inside of us that we're protecting and feeding and maintaining. And that little mini-me is like a kind of psychic contraction from belonging. And it's no one's fault that we all have this. It's a product of our evolutionary past, probably. There was something useful about it in terms of survival. But it's not all we are. We have the ability to see through this illusion. And our practice of mindfulness is a very powerful tool for it. We actually, there is no self in just a sensation of throbbing, for instance. There's actually a very subtle, you know, almost subconscious labeling of throbbing as being in the knee, and then it's my knee. And we actually construct the self out of our sensory experience. In the bare sensory experience, there is no construct. If you're just with sound, if you're just with sensation, if you're just with taste or smell or sight, there isn't a separateness. We actually construct it. We create our suffering. And so the path of mindfulness is all about seeing through that delusion. So that's one way of thinking of enlightenment, is dropping the illusion of separateness. A kind of classical definition coming out of Theravada Buddhism is that an awakened being is someone who doesn't even have the potential to feel greed or aversion or delusion. Those are the three root afflictive states of mind, and all of our afflictions are one flavor of those. So aversion has lots of flavors: fear, irritation, jealousy, etc. So, in theory, a fully awake being is incapable of those having those feelings anymore. They still have feelings and a human heart and compassion and gratitude and love and kindness, but the afflictions are purified out of the heart. So one story in the suttas is two monks. I don't remember the names, but one guy thought he was completely fully awake. The other guy knew he wasn't quite. He was almost. So the other guy, with his psychic powers — these are just the way the stories go — manifested an elephant to charge at him, and the guy got afraid. And so that showed to the guy that he wasn't fully awake, because a fully awake being, in theory, is incapable of feeling fear. And I was once at a teaching from a very, supposedly very awake monk from Thailand, Ajahn Jumian, who said he hadn't felt fear in 25 years. Can you imagine? Poor thing. I'm not sure I would agree with that. Poor thing. Why do you say that?
Fear has really lots of teachers.
Yeah.
It seems like it's part of the human spectrum, and to take yourself out of that, I don't know. I guess I have my doubts.
Yeah, doubts. So. Fear is just a part of the human spectrum, doesn't really have to be problematic, even, I'm guessing you would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's just be clear. This was not like some checked out zombie kind of person. This was a person, very, if you met him, very joyful, very alive, you know. So, you know, I don't know. I was surprised when he said that, you know, that he said that. So I think maybe there's just, if you felt his heart, I think you might feel differently. Yeah. So that's one way of looking at awakening. But let's make it more practical. Oh, well there's another way. A third way, so the first way is the dissolving of our separateness. The second way is not the potential for an afflictive emotion. Lots of other connected emotions still available, but not the afflictive ones. A third way would be to look at it from the Dzogchen tradition in Tibetan Buddhism, which is a non-dual way of approaching awareness or mindfulness. And in that approach, they talk about recognizing the nature of mind. The nature of mind is one of pure awareness, one where mindfulness or awareness, I'm using them interchangeably, occur without effort and without a self doing it. There's just presence or awareness or being. And we recognize that that's the truth of our mind, is the first part of the path. The second part of the path is then simply stabilizing. When you have an experience of pure awareness, it does actually pierce the veil of separateness. And there's just a deep feeling of presence and belonging. So that's another way of approaching this question of awakening. It's stabilizing this ability or this experience of pure awareness, awareness without effort. Okay, so now a fourth. And this is where I think it's probably most relevant to us. The completely awake heart is a heart that doesn't care if the next moment is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So the Buddha boiled down our difficulty to the fact that we only want the pleasant. Every experience you have has this quality of feeling tone. Feeling tone is pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Every thought, sensation, image, sound is either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And our struggle is that we only want the pleasant, and yet we get unpleasant and neutral. So much more like close to our heart and our life, we could all get a sense, I think, that if we truly are okay with having a pleasant experience, a neutral experience, or an unpleasant experience, we're actually really doing well. We are really feeling free in our heart. In other words, you won't care if a drunk, smelly, obnoxious person sits down next to you on the bus, because you're just going to be noticing unpleasantness. And you'll just keep being aware of unpleasantness. And it actually, you will have the ability to not be disturbed by the unpleasantness. So this is the theory, you know, if this does link up to an arhant, a fully awake being, not having greed, aversion, or delusion. Because greed, aversion, and delusion are in relation to pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. We have greed for the pleasant, aversion to the unpleasant, and we're deluded or ignore the neutral. So, but imagine you truly being okay with knee pain, truly being okay with an itch, truly being okay with fear, an unpleasant emotion, truly being okay with an unpleasant thought. you actually, your well-being is not defined by the kind of experience you're having. And this is not pie in the sky. This is the exact point of mindfulness practice. Mindfulness practice replaces reacting to feeling tone with interest and curiosity about it. Interest in and curiosity about it. We replace reaction with mindfulness. That is the path, in essence. And so we basically back into well-being. We're sitting here being aware of breath, being aware of sensation, being aware of sound. The very skill of doing that is going to eventually, as your practice deepens, convert into equanimity. Just being okay, no matter what. And so when Buddhism talks about the deathless, this is what they're talking about. It's not some pie-in-the-sky thing that we might experience way, way down the line when we wake up. It's something you can experience right now. So you understand equanimity if instead of scratching an itch on your shoulder, you've just turned your attention to it and observed it. And you've just watched it, and it's unpleasant, and you might even observe that, oh, there's some aversion, and then you observe desire to scratch, but you just keep watching, and eventually the itch just sort of takes care of itself. It's impermanent, so it leaves. So that's a little micro moment of nibbana, of actual freedom, where you were no longer chained to reaction to feeling tone. You replaced it with mindfulness. So that's our path. And that is the deathless. That penetrates the veil of our separateness. And it actually puts us in being. We're in a place of real depth of presence and being when we can just watch an itch without scratching it. So awakening for us, moment to moment, is really about our relationship with pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And we're replacing reacting to it with mindfulness. And that is equanimity. And equanimity is this deep, deep, abiding, restful happiness. We're just okay, no matter what. So again, enlightenment in some lofty sense might not be your goal at all. But how about being okay in your life, in your mind, in your body, as pleasant, unpleasant, neutral does its dance? The Buddha boiled it down to something so clear and simple. If you make peace with pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, you're good. You're doing really well. So, two people jogging, they've got weights, they're jogging, they looked really fit. If you really had to choose, which would it be, enlightenment or buns of steel? It might be a tough choice in Boulder here, because buns of steel, you know, we really like buns of steel here in Boulder. I have more to say, but at this point, I'm just going to stop and just see if you have questions or comments. If I could just summarize, we take death as a spur for our spiritual path. May it give us urgency to be very present, to actually really come into being. And then I said a lot about what awakening is. And so any questions or comments? Please. Yes, equanimity transcends pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, but the experience of equanimity, calm, open, connected presence, very pleasant. So I can qualify a little more. Glad you kept going. If you're really like resting in deep equanimity, it's very pleasant. Sometimes just sort of momentary equanimity like that, it might be just neutral. So there are variations of it, but it's in the neutral to pleasant zone. It's never unpleasant. It's always either neutral or pleasant. But we often experience neutral. Remember, if we go with this idea of a contrasting nervous system, neutral itself can feel like a huge relief from our normal turbulence. Our reactivity to feeling tone is turbulence or dukkha, suffering. So equanimity, even when it's neutral, can feel like a real relief. You're just with things as they are. So momentary equanimity tends to be neutral, but when equanimity is more abiding, it's pleasant. Well, everything has feeling tone. Because it's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It's a good question. But usually when we're in a place of equanimity, we're in a place of rest, ease, presence. It's quite pleasant. Uh-huh. Yeah. So when equanimity meets real life, it isn't indifference. It's responsiveness. So we can say reactivity is like, oh my God, like we freak out about it. Responsiveness is to take appropriate action without extra fuss. It's to just do what needs to be done. So a clear, equanimous heart would just take action to intervene and stop if stopping could happen. Yeah. And it for most of us might take real courage, you know? So courage might be a quality that comes in, a kind of fearlessness. So absolutely, we don't ever want to confuse equanimity with passivity. The clearer we are, the more effective our action will be. Because we see the situation. We see there's a square peg going in a round hole. If we don't see clearly, we're just going to keep trying to jam the peg. Seeing clearly is understanding, oh, there's a square peg trying to be put in a round hole. It ain't ever going to work. Take the peg away. So that's a very important question, too. Yeah. So we're going to do a contemplation, not now, but in a little bit. And I just want to say a little bit about it so that I can be less wordy when we do it. We're going to actually contemplate our mortality. And the contemplation has some parts to it. So the first is to remind yourself that I am of the nature to die. This mind, this body, this personality has an expiration date. And I'll say more in the contemplation, but you're going to actually purposefully direct your thoughts along those lines. So this is a contemplation that there's a variation of it. I was advised to do every day when I was a kind of monk in training in Thailand. This is a variation of the five reflections. It's a daily contemplation that the Buddha recommended. So in the first contemplation, we really just consider that this actual, what I consider me, has an expiration date. And it's certain. Maybe the only guarantee in life is that we're mortal. The second reflection is that it's uncertain when that'll happen. I don't know. I could live to be 99 like my grandmother, or, you know, die in my late 50s like my grandfather. I don't know. You don't know. We just don't know. So the third reflection is, when I die, I have to let go of everything. Completely surrender. Let go. All your loved ones, all your friends, all your abilities, all the joy you take in connecting with nature, every skill, every memory, every accomplishment, we let go of all of it. And this is just the truth. This is a fact. So Pablo Neruda has some lines. Shoot, I'm missing the what poem this is from. Somewhere in my notes. Okay, I don't have the title of the poem that it's from. He said this, wrote this, "We the mortals touch the metals, the wind, the ocean shore, the stones, knowing they will go on, inert or burning. And I was discovering, naming all these things. It was my destiny to love and say goodbye." So we the mortals, we're mortal. And we're involved with the phenomenal world. We touch the metals, the wind, the ocean shore, the stones. And he said, "It was my destiny to love and say goodbye." So the fullness of life asks us both things. We can get sort of caught on the, like, well, I have to just let go. But it's easy to let go if you're not really connected. But life also asks of us to love, and love well, and love deeply, and run the error, the risk of getting attached. Of course we get attached. And then we must say goodbye. So it's a beautiful little distillation of what mortality asks of us. Life demands that we love, because how else can we live life? And death demands we say goodbye. We need both things. We need to know how to let go of what's in our hand, not what's just discarded on the ground. We need to let go of of our partners, our children, our bodies. We let go as we love. And so our mortality demands that we say goodbye. But wisdom says, say goodbye as you go. Like Ajahn Chah said, this glass is already broken. When that's our understanding, it's not morose. It's poignant. It's precious to love what's flowing. We understand it. So we're not going to be that involved in the third reflection, but we'll be more simple when the time comes. So the fourth, then, reflection here is, given the fact that death is certain, when it happens is uncertain, and I have to let go of everything. Given that, what do I want my life to look like? How can death be my teacher to live? What matters most to me? What will give me rest and peace to contemplate as I move towards dying? What can I do in my life for myself, for others, so that I know I've lived well? We'll reflect on that. So I'll repeat all of that in the contemplation. It'll be more simple. And let's lighten the load a little bit. Death humor. Okay, here's the Grim Reaper. You just have to see it. He's in a house. He or she, or maybe they're not on the gender binary. they have a little sickle or whatever, and there's a dead man and a dead cat. And then there's a little tiny plant, and the Grim Reaper is kind of just casting death towards the tiny plant, saying, "God, I'm such a perfectionist." So, if you do die, and you do happen to go to hell, Gary Larson has a cartoon, Nerds in Hell, and people are in line with flames all around, and the nerd, very friendly, nice guy, is saying to another guy, "Hot enough for ya?" I don't know, I just think that's really funny. Nerds in Hell. Oh, and the death of the dinosaurs. Two dinosaurs sitting on a little clump of rock. It's pouring rain, and there's a boat leaving with two animals of each kind on the boat disappearing into the distance, and one dinosaur is saying to the other, "Crap, was that today?" Okay. This is a huge topic. There's a lot more I wanted to say, but not time. But I do want to just touch in a little bit on working with impermanence as a teaching from death. So death is this very macro expression of impermanence. If we orient to the micro expressions of impermanence in our life, it really prepares us for the big impermanence. So that's why in our sit, I had you focus on sensation and whether it's changing or not, and then sound and whether it's changing or not. This is a very helpful practice to orient to, because our language completely obfuscates the truth of impermanence. For instance, when we started out this morning, we did a 30-minute sit. What's wrong with that statement? It's a massively diluted statement. The delusion is, we call it a 30-minute sit, like it's a noun, like it's a book on a shelf. But what was your morning sit like? Well, I'm guessing there was a lot of flow in it. There was thoughts changing, moods changing. You probably went into, some times where you were more aware, other times you felt more distracted. All of that flow happens, and we obscure it with just the word, it's a sit, it's a meditation. Or how about I'm giving a talk? It's been nothing but flow. You went for a drive. You went for a run. You went out on a date. All of those words, those are just taking experiences and converting them into nouns and thereby deluding us into thinking that there's these solid things that happen. They don't. Remember, from birth to death, it's just like this. It's flow. Our experience is flow. And so meditating on change is very helpful. If you orient to change in sensation, if you orient to change in sound, those are two areas, especially sound, where you just see a lot of change. If you think your body's changeable, your mind is way more changeable. We just don't have time in the scope of today to focus on thoughts. But thoughts are changing like this. When you're not lost in the thoughts, when you're just observing them, they're just pinballing off each other in association, going all over the place. So thoughts, images, sounds, sensations, so changeable. And we need to do that practice a lot because we have spent 10,000 repetitions a day. I mean, I'm just making up the number, but, you know, thousands of repetitions in the way we think and talk in solidifying our experience that isn't solid. So our death is simply an expression of our life, which is impermanence. Everything we do is flowing. And the more we orient to that, the less attached we become. When you see it's all flow, you actually can't exactly park in an experience. It's coming and it's going. So you wake up and you're a little bit grumpy, so you get grouchy, but you know, then you have your morning cup of coffee and you feel a little better and you go to work and it's really going well. But then at 11 o'clock, you have the tense meeting and that's not going so well. And then you start to question your self-worth. But then you have a delicious lunch, you know, and then you get a stressful phone call and then there's a crisis with your child at school and blah, blah, blah. Have you ever not had a day like that? It's flow. Your life is flowing. Flow, flow, flow. So observe. And when you see it's flow, then there's a bunch of things you'll do differently. For instance, if you're at a nice pool and it has a little waterfall and there's little rainbows refracting off the light of the waterfall, you might bathe in it, you might take a picture of it, you might bring a friend to see the pretty waterfall, but there's one thing you wouldn't do. Lean on it. You would not lean on a waterfall. That would be silly. You just wouldn't do it. Why? Because you see clearly. So, you are the waterfall. Your moods, your thoughts, the sensations in your body, your experience is this cascade of impressions. To think you could park in any one experience is like leaning on a waterfall. The more you see that it's flow, the less you're going to depend on feeling a certain way. So orienting to impermanence is really helpful. It aligns you with how things are, and then you suffer less because you don't take a spill in the waterfall. You just relate to it. We still relate to the whole chaos of our lives, but we're in a much more equanimous place because we understand its nature. It's not supposed to be a certain way. always. It, the only way it's going to be is changing. We know that. So you can keep focusing on impermanence as you practice. We'll do a contemplation in our next sit.